Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 380. Okay, head over to the Nerdist channel right now and see Lando Calrissian singing karaoke at Mos Eisley Karaoke Night with about 18 Cantina creatures and Patton Oswalt and Jason Schwartzman and myself and Skydart and a bunch of people. This was a big thing that we worked on a few weeks back and rebuilt the Cantina set for it. So it was all to sort of celebrate the kickoff of Course of the Force. So go over to the Nerdist channel, youtube.com/Nerdist, and click subscribe while you're there. Because it's easy. It's just a click of a button. Because we have not quite yet mastered the art of the mind meld telekinetic click yet. But as soon as we do, I will let you know. But for now, you have to use your finger just one time. That sounded weird. I would like to thank for sponsoring this episode of Nerdist Podcast, LegalZoom. Whatever you want to do, if you want to form a business or if you want to create something, you need to protect yourself. And you can trust LegalZoom to help make that happen. They've been helping Americans get personalized wills, powers of attorney, living trusts, also incorporation, LLC, trademarks, real estate documents. It was developed by a team of experienced attorneys, and they're going to take care of you from start to finish. If you're a parent or an entrepreneur, don't wait. Call or visit LegalZoom.com and just see how easy it is to get legally protected. Isn't that a nice term, legally protected? LegalZoom can provide self-help services at your specific direction or connect you with an attorney, but they're not a law firm. For more savings, be sure to enter Nerdist in the referral box at checkout. That's LegalZoom.com, promo code Nerdist. This is Charlie. It's a week of Charlies, who also happen to be in Pacific Rim, which, by the way, we saw it last night, and I can't... Matt Myra and I were like, holy shit, we could see it again. It is... I mean, the billboards that you see do not do the film justice. You've got... It's stunning. Absolutely stunning. I was nervous because I love Guillermo, and I didn't want to be disappointed by it, and I was absolutely not. So I cannot recommend that you go see it enough. It's one of those movies that you're going to want to see two or three times. It's the scale of the creatures and the Jaegers is... It's fucking gorgeous, so I'm sorry for gushing about it, but it is, I could not love it more. So when we recorded this podcast with Charlie Day, who's also terrific in the movie, we hadn't seen the movie yet, so we just saw it last night, we went to the premiere, so, and by the way, Charlie, totally just fucking cool guy, really, really cool dude, who is hilarious, and you should watch It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia if you don't already. Watch it again after you go see Pacific Rim. Here's the Nerdist Podcast number 380 with Charlie Day, who we kind of look similar. It's like, I feel like we're like podcasting my cousin.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Do you want to put your headphones on or just like them around your neck?
I want to look like a DJ while we do this.
I like that.
Yeah. Well, except that you lack any turntables or even
you can spin your coffee.
Yeah, exactly. No, let me get, I have an app.
You have an app? You get your DJ app? Hey, are there real DJs anymore? There are real DJs now.
Sure.
I think so.
It all happens in the studio now, right? It's not like the mixing stuff.
Well, they're more composers, I guess, because Daft Punk, you would used to call them DJs, and now they just compose music.
When I used to go to raves in college.
Here we go.
Do you think a DJ composer would, like, call himself a composer if he was standing next to like Philip Glass?
You know, like, I think he would. I think he would.
You know,
would
he have the guts?
Yeah, I think he would. He wouldn't understand why it's a shitty thing.
Yeah.
Man, there was a guy.
You know, composers like us.
Yeah.
There was a guy. I'm sorry. I'm Hans Zimmer. Who are you?
Sweet DJ name.
Hans.
What club do you work at?
The Titanic. There was this guy named DJ Dan, and he had three turntables, and it was this insane seamless. I don't know how they get the. He'd have the headphone on, and then in one ear, roo, 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 and then bam, mix something in, flip the record, drop another plate on, put another thing over there.
I saw Beck in like 98, and his DJ like would do crazy shit and also juggle records while scratching records.
Did he have two turntables and a mic?
No. Beck did.
Yeah.
Yes. But the DJ.
I've seen that guy. He was amazing.
Yeah. I think that was that A-Track? I can't remember.
I think you have to like be able to pull tricks like that because you're not actually playing an instrument. So you got to like really, you know, put some shine.
Well, there are electronic bands now that I go, when you go see them in concert, is it just so you can point at them and go, there they are? Like you're just pointing. It's like an appearance.
I find that to be an awful experience. Yeah, I did that once, not realizing that there was no band and that this was just like pretty much a guy pushing buttons.
Listening party. Hey, come over. I'll play some tapes.
One of the first hip hop groups I ever saw was Roots, and I was like, wow, live hip hop is like the best thing to see ever. It's fucking incredible. And then I went and saw just like an MC with like a backing track, and I was like, this is the worst. Constant experience of my life.
Yeah.
You might as well just go out to your car and open up the back and then put a speaker in it. Yeah, go, everyone just gather around. Yeah.
And then put too many people around where you're not sure why they're there on stage.
And if you can get a Tupac hologram, then
that's all you need.
See, that's
then
you
have a real party.
Yeah.
Could you get a Tupac hologram just to drive around the city?
Yeah, just one for the so you can use the carpool lane.
How many times do people do this? You should totally do that on your show. See, that's sort of the danger of being a writer EP on your show is that people are constantly like, you should use that. You're like, oh, thanks. How many times have you ever actually used an idea that someone's like, you should use that?
Probably never.
probably never.
But Larry David did that. He picked up a hooker to use the carpool lane to get to a Dodgers game.
And that episode,
Curb.
Did you, the thing about that episode, it ended up it turned out there was a guy that was accused of murder.
Right.
And he was in that scene at the Dodger Stadium in that episode of Curb.
Oh, that got him off.
Yeah, that got him off.
We haven't gotten anyone out of jail, so that's
probably the opposite, if anything.
Yeah, that could be. Yeah. It could be. So we're still trying to live up to Larry David.
Well, see, that's how you should get, that's how you could get extras for things, to be like, come get an alibi.
Yeah.
No one can say you murdered anyone today.
Yeah, you know, you're not doing when you're being an extra, committing crimes,
you're
guys.
You're not committing crimes. I just spent 5 days in Philadelphia, and it's a fucking great city. And I always felt bad because I always just kind of sort of lumped it in, like, oh, it's one of those East Coast. But you go there, and there's a higher density of historical things in one small area.
Yeah. Are you from out here?
No, I'm from Tennessee.
Oh, Tennessee.
Yeah.
Sure.
So I live in an oldish part of the country, but not like...
Not super old. Not guys with buckles on their hats.
I don't live in the origin story of the United States.
Well, you're from the South where everything historic was burned down.
Yeah, it was burned down. Right. Some of it we don't talk about
anymore. Sorry about that.
Exactly. There are some buildings in the South where it's a totally different tone that you have when you go to Philadelphia. You're like, wow, this is where .. happened. But in the South, you go and go, wow, this is where they used to do horrible things.
Youth Center, and that just seems wrong.
There's always a whisper to it.
But Philadelphia, we went to the Mutter Museum, which was fucking have you been to the Mutter Museum?
No.
It's basically a medical oddities museum in the College of Physicians. It's just right downtown. And it's fucking they have slivers of Einstein's brain.
Oh, someone was just telling me about this the other day.
Yeah, just like as appetizers when you
come in. Yeah, you come in, good. Just a little, like, just melts under your tongue.
Like sashimi.
Yeah.
Mm,
it's like a real, put a little jalapeno on it.
It's like
makes you smarter.
E equals sashimi squared.
There's a lot of like weird fused skeletons and drawers full of things that were pulled out of people. And
you have to open up these drawers?
Giants and tiny people. Yeah, you have to do a modicum of work.
Yeah.
To see a bunch of, but there are this doctor who removed things that people shouldn't have swallowed, saved everything that he ever pulled out of people. And so you have all these drawers, and it's just all these pins, and you're just like, perfect attendance, just all these weird pins.
Oh, that's fucking great.
That people swallowed, and medical oddities, and what else? It's so creepy and awesome.
Yeah.
Philadelphia is a city where I've seen the most blatant littering that I've seen
in
any other city. I saw multiple times guys like leaning up against a garbage can and then like finishing a sandwich and throwing, like they could easily just let go. And
but
it
he went
been,
the opposite direction.
They just threw it to the side. Like twice. I saw that twice.
Yeah. That is the most blatant littering. And like, unless you were in the garbage can, I don't think there's any more.
Yeah.
And then a guy dressed like Ben Franklin came and sweeped it up.
Yeah.
On there. Let's see. Went to there, Mutter Museum. The Eastern State Penitentiary, which is fucking unreal. Did you ever, have you ever been there?
No.
I don't know why I assume like, well, because of your show, technically, you probably.
Yeah. No, I'm not even from Philly.
I've never even been there.
Yeah, I've been a couple times.
Some B-roll shots, that's about
it. Yeah, I go B-roll shots. Yeah.
All right, I'm just going to tell you one more thing because I'm very excited about it. The Eastern State Penitentiary is the oldest penitentiary in the country, and it was built in 1824. And the idea, it was like a monastery, and they figured, oh, for people who've committed serious crimes, we will essentially put them – that's where the penitentiary comes from, the word penitent. They wanted people to basically go and sit alone for 2 years to rediscover their humanity.
Yeah.
And they realized fairly quickly, like, oh, when you isolate crazy psychopaths, they just get angrier.
Yeah.
So
2 years to just sort of think about what you did.
Yeah.
And how you can do it better.
Yeah.
Yep. And so then the prison expanded and it became more of like a community.
Philadelphia.
Yeah. It became more like Philadelphia. Yeah. But it's a stunning thing. If you're ever in Philadelphia, you should go to the Eastern State Penitentiary. You just see the evolution of the prison go from this really nice kind of a monastery to this filthy, and they've left most of it just in ruins, and you can just wander around freely. It's really awesome.
And what were those crimes too? You know, like
everything. In the early days?
Yeah. You talk to a witch.
I want you to think about what
don't
you did.
Don't think about that.
I don't think she was a witch. You think about it.
Well, she's my sister. Well, you, yeah. think, you were speaking with her.
So you're a witch?
Witch family.
Witch?
A whole witch family.
She, I think it was horse thievery and murder stuff and stealing things.
Forward thinking.
A little bit of forward thinking.
Forward thinking.
Yeah. The guy who first started the internet was put in there, and then we didn't actually get it after that. But Philadelphia is an amazing town. But let's actually talk about your show, which is more relevant than the actual city of Philadelphia.
Sure.
How we talked a little bit about this in Monsters University Junket. Did you how did the pitch for the show come together? It's like I feel like for a while the show's partially improvised.
Yeah.
And so that was a thing after Curb that everyone was like, let's go make a partially improvised show. And then none of them worked.
Right. Well, I think the problem is that, we script everything really carefully. And sometimes, you know, 4, 5, 6 scenes go by without an improvised line. But we always try to improvise in the scene. So we will write something out. We'll write the entire episode, you know. So we're not improvising a car crash or whatever's, you know, the key sort of plot point in the story. But then when we get down to set, we'll goof around and we'll do a couple takes as scripted and throw it away. And that's sort of different than like the Larry David thing, which I think is he has like an outline and a roadmap,
sort of,
and they kind
of
go like that. Yeah,
which is dangerous because what I've seen a lot of partially improvised shows fail at is that they let them go. I think you need a structure. You need some sort of structure.
Well, you need an out. You need an out.
Yeah,
from
because
a scene.
Because what happens is the improvisers will naturally just start one-upping, even if it takes the scene in a completely a direction that they can't possibly justify.
Right.
It's like, you know, argument, 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 argument. I was abducted by what? You were abducted by aliens? And
like
they just spit out a crazy.
Right. And then they're like, all right, well, how are we going to work this into the rest of the episode?
Yeah. They're basically going for like the blackout line.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know if that's how it works over on Curb, but yeah, no, we're very sort of traditional. You know, we go into a writer's room and we break stories and we, you know, write outlines, and then off those outlines we kind of pitch jokes and then we write scripts.
But your show is one of the shows that sort of established FX as, oh, they kind of actually do cool different stuff, and it seems like they were sort of leading the charge of cable channels who said, hey, we'll take a group of creative people and just sort of let them carry out the thing that they want to do and not get too involved.
They have an amazing business model over there, which really is sort of like, here's a blank check, artists, and make what you want to make. And, you know, that either comes out like Sunny or Louie, or sometimes it comes out like Starved, which we were teamed up with when we got launched and, you know, it came and went. But
Dan Pasternak joint.
Oh, was it really?
Yeah, it was.
Oh, I don't remember.
That was at IFC.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
But yeah, that's like the best way to work.
Well, but it's very difficult for – it's very non-networky to not get involved. It's very – like everyone feels like they have to give notes to justify, yeah, I'm doing something today. It's weird to just set back.
Yeah. No, and any time they did give us notes, they were actually really sort of good observations that were like, oh, right, we're feeling that too. We're seeing that is wrong in this episode and we'll try and fix it. But the way they get away with that is they don't pay anyone anything.
Right.
You know, like they start out saying, well, here's $9. If you can make a TV show, go, you know,
and for the, and for creative, for the artist, it's totally worth it. Cause you're like, well, I will take my payment in creative freedom as opposed to,
yeah, yeah, absolutely. And then, and like ownership too, which was like, it was a gamble, which is like, look, this is yours and we own it together. And if it works, then, you know, that's, then you'll benefit, and if it bombs, then you know, we gave you a shot, and
you were, I think you would work harder because you're more invested in like, oh shit, you guys, like you become more entrepreneurial and less like, oh, I just got a sweet check, and if it doesn't work out, I don't give a shit, I get paid a lot of money, like you earn it.
I think, yeah, I think money can kind of spoil things. Do you want me to keep hitting the microphone like,
yeah,
this?
Yeah,
is this,
yeah,
good,
yeah,
for
I can put this one over there too, just so you can
in a couple
do it
of days.
Yeah. Just, if you want to just have one hand on that one too.
A lot of banging on the table is good.
Yeah, just like constantly I'm like giving this thing a hand job.
Podcast stomp.
Get some keys. I remember the when the tape was floating around of the like original kind of pilot thing that you guys made.
Right.
I remember it was just this, like, you know, like friends, like BJ Porter was like a writer on Mr. Show. He's like, I have this tape, but these guys made this show on their own and then like sold it. And it, yeah, was like, it was based in Los Angeles.
Right.
And I think it was like you guys were trying to get dates. And so you were acting like you were doing a casting session? Was that,
yeah, the, yeah. That was our second episode. We did two episodes on our own.
Okay.
And I think it was the second one that we sold. Actually, we did it three times. We did it once with David Hornsby playing the character of Mac. He's a writer-producer of ours, and he sometimes plays this great guy named Rickety Cricket. We shot it. We shot it in our apartments. We were all holding the camera, real sort of cheap and handheld. But again, it was scripted beginning to end, and then we would sort of riff and find better versions of the dialogue, you know, while doing it. And then we looked at it and we said, "That's not that good," which I think is something that people don't do. Like, yeah, oftentimes, yeah, like people will hand you something and be like, "Look at this! It's, yeah, the greatest! I did it!" And
that's the internet.
Yeah, yeah, I know. Well, that's, yeah, what it's become. And fortunately, we were like really before everything was just sort of getting vomited onto the internet.
Yeah, it was pre-YouTube.
Yeah, it was like just when YouTube was getting going. So we looked at it and we're like, "Oh, this isn't great, but if we can get it together to do this one more time, I bet we can fix these little problems." We did it one more time and we're like, "That's pretty good." And that's the one we started showing like our agents and things, and everyone was like, "Yeah, we see a show in there." And we waited forever to get like teamed up with a Hollywood name to help us go pitch it. Like, we were waiting for like Jon Favreau to look at it, or I'm forgetting the guy's name, the guy who ran Sex and the City.
Michael Patrick King?
Yeah, I think so. You know, like there are all these sort of like people who were available in the business at the time. This was before Favreau really blew up as a director. Who certainly maybe would have helped it, but we were just waiting and waiting. And while we were waiting, we're like, "Fuck it, let's just do another episode." I can swear here, right?
This is. I don't appreciate it, but yeah.
Jonah has very sensitive ears.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Jonah. I'll be more tender with you.
Take your headphones off every time.
That's what I told you.
Yeah. So, Jonah, we said, "Oh darn it, let's just stop waiting and do another one."
Oh, Jesus, so nice.
Yeah, that's the one I think you saw. The one where the guys were like having a fake casting call to meet girls.
Yeah, and they were just bringing them all to their apartment.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. I remember really. Everyone wanted to hate it.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, I'm sure.
Like, these guys just fucking do it, and then like, oh fuck.
Well, that's the art. That's sort of the jealousy gene of like, who do those guys think they are doing a thing that I probably should be doing, but I'm not doing?
Yeah,
exactly. How dare you try to get ahead when I'm over here drinking every night, thinking of ideas?
Hey,
that I.
That's a bad gene. You gotta like try to squash that because then you don't
do anything.
You know, you shut yourself down. I think with that.
Well, it is. It's a bad. Not only does it crush creativity, but it also then it gets you working from a place of, I don't know, a little more desperation rather than like, hey, I should just go make a thing. I think everyone should collaborate with everyone. I think collaboration is the best. I mean, that whole, I do this and fuck those guys over there. I never understood that.
Yeah. I mean, I think we all have it. You know, you all see like Justin Timberlake hosting Saturday Night Live for the millionth time. And you're like, this guy, here he goes again. And then you sit and you watch it and you're like, hey, he's charming. Yeah. He's good.
Funny.
He's super talented.
Great voice.
He can sing and dance. I was like, I want to be friends with him. Yeah. You know,
it goes from fuck that guy to, oh, fuck this guy.
Yeah.
Shit.
Yeah. So if you can shut it off, it's good. I think if you hang on to it and then, you know.
Well, it's almost like the watching people's succeed can be like a negative mirror in a way where it just reminds you of all the things you're not doing or reminds you of all the things that maybe you're not good at, or I don't know. It's but it's definitely, I mean, again, and that's a lot of the internet.
Yeah, well, that's what the internet. Finally, there's a place for people to vent about that kind of stuff.
Where did people vent before? I feel like bathroom graffiti's gone way down.
Yeah,
places where people used to vent.
Do you think there was bathroom graffiti like there is Twitter? You know, like Mark Hamill would walk into a bathroom stall and be like,
yep,
"Star Wars sucks." He'd be like, "Star Wars sucks."
Yeah, sure. And then someone would basically, you know, he'd write, eat my giant hairy balls, and you go to a gas station across town and it would say RG for re-graffiti. Eat my hairy balls.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Right.
They were basically graffiti was comment threads. Those were the comment threads.
It was their hashtags.
Yeah.
We did it. We did it before. Well, they were I think there was a story in Team of Rivals, the Abraham Lincoln book. But apparently Lincoln seemed like kind of an affable guy in public, and he was a good storyteller, but he didn't swear, he wasn't, you know, he wasn't like a commoner, but I guess he told one story where there was a picture of George Washington hanging in an outhouse, and there was like his reasoning was something along the lines of like, nothing makes a British man shit more than the sight of George Washington. It was just like one of those clever, even back then they would hang stuff in the bathrooms.
That's good.
Doesn't it feel like we invented that, but that's probably been going on since we started walking upright?
I think so.
I don't know. I feel like because bathrooms sort of happened after this country, right? Otherwise, there was this sort of holes, weren't they?
No,
like
I'm sure in Rome, I'm sure there was. They had bathrooms and stuff like that, but it just took too long to, you know.
They have proper bathrooms in Rome.
I'm sure they
and it's
had
really hard to wipe your ass with marble.
It is,
yeah. It just smears
it's just
it around.
It's just a little slide outside of it. You just gotta kind of spread the cheeks and slide down.
That's where the first water parks came from. Is they were actually places to wipe your ass.
And the first graffiti: Caesar's a douche.
D-O-V-C-H-E.
Yeah, douche.
So you guys are working on the next season of Sunny now. Were you writing it now? Yeah.
No, we're editing already.
Oh, you're editing.
We shot the whole thing and we're ready to roll.
Is that because I remember the Concords guys said that one of the reasons why they didn't want to come back and do a season three was like, well, because it's literally the entire year. They have to write everything, then they have to shoot everything, then they have to edit everything, then they have a couple weeks off, and then
they
also have
to start.
How are those guys feeling about that now, though? Like, I always wonder about that, like, you know, like, oh, I don't know. It's like, it takes up so much time.
I think HBO offered them a shit ton of money to come back because they kept saying no.
Yeah.
But I honestly, they really didn't. It's funny. They worked for years to build up this thing. And then when it sort of paid off, they were done with it. And they really don't care. I think they really don't care.
Well, they also had to make
a
song.
Did they not care for like a year? Were they like, you know, like for like a year, they're like, we don't care. And now like, you know, 3-4 years go by and people
maybe
are like, who are they playing the Concords?
Maybe,
oh, right.
Yeah.
And which sucks because the guys are amazing.
They
you
turned
know?
Down SNL. Like I remember there was a story where they their agent called them to tell them the HBO show got picked up. And they're like, hey guys, the show got picked up. And they were like, oh, can we call you back? We're eating.
Yeah, right.
They
right,
just didn't really.
Rather not.
Yeah, but not. But weirdly, they're such sweet, charming guys that it didn't seem pretentious when they. It wasn't like, oh, come on. Like it really felt like, yeah, really, I don't really.
No, yeah, I don't think it does come from pretension, but I do think it's like dumb. I think it's really, you know, I mean, I just want to, first of all, I'm sure everyone loves the show. They were super funny. I love the show. I enjoyed watching it. And why not just a couple more? You don't have to do a billion of them.
I also, like, did they have to do it so soon? They could have taken a break.
Like, Louis taking a year off.
Yeah.
But I think you know, the other thing is that that first season, I think, was essentially the culmination of 7 or 8 years of work of
the BBC show and touring.
And they were tested, and they knew, like, everything was going to be – it was all their A-list stuff. And then after that, it's like, oh – We have to do 8 years worth of work in 3 months.
That's true, because it's just like, you know, the first season was all songs they had already had. And the second season, they had to write all new songs. It's just like, you know, sophomore.
That's why second albums are tough.
Yeah,
second albums, you spend your whole life writing the first one. But you guys really just, that was your first, was that your first project together when you started making the episodes?
Yeah. But so, we're 9 years in, you know, 104 episodes. So, like, I hear these guys being like, I had to work a whole year. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Oh, but look, I mean, I guess if they're happy or they come for money, I don't know. Like, I mean, they must. I don't understand.
I never walk away from it. I think they do okay back home.
There's good sheep farming there.
Yes, exactly.
Well, Brett won the Oscar for the Muppet Movie soundtrack.
Yeah, so they're still busy.
And then he's in a traveling ukulele band that tours like New Zealand and Australia.
So they're good. They really don't care.
I don't think they care. But I remember the whole time. That was the one time where I would get jealous in the sense where they would have these opportunities that I felt like I would do anything for those opportunities. And they were like, no. I'd be like, what? You know, like, you start to get selfish. You're like, just do it for me, please. Just do it so that someone can do it.
You know, like, do they have kids?
Yeah, they have kids now. Yeah.
But maybe there's good money in traveling ukulele bands. I don't know.
Well, you don't hear about them, and they could be the one.
Just enough.
Yeah. Are they fulfilled in their lives outside of creativity and being on TV?
Probably. They live in New Zealand.
Whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. They're sticking in New Zealand. They're not moving to downtown LA or wherever.
No, I think I see Jermaine in Silver Lake all the time. I think he's kind of – I see him all around.
Is he hanging out?
Yeah.
Yeah. See, like those coffees are expensive.
They are.
Man.
Who's going to pay for those?
3-4 seasons would have helped that out. You know? Coffee for life, I think.
How do you – I think you'll be an amazing person to talk about this, but I always ask writers about pushing – and comedy people about pushing through the wall. When you've done so many seasons of your show and it's like – what the fuck is left where you just feel empty but you're sitting in front of a computer or however you write and you have to write something by the end of the day?
That's the only reason you get it done, and that's the best way to do it. I don't know. Has Woody Allen been making a movie a year for, you know, however many years he's done it, or how did Larry David do that many Seinfelds? We're only doing 10 episodes a year, so I think we can come up with 10 good ideas in the course of a year. You know, but yeah, it does. It is true. We do walk in there and say, "Gosh, it's the 9th season. We've done absolutely everything." But last year, in our 8th year, we were just sort of backed up against the wall, like you're asking about. And then I think because of those limitations, I suppose, had to sort of dig deeper and find better things. I think it's like one of our best seasons we've ever done. So I don't know. They're good problems to have. It's good to be out of ideas. It's the only way you come up with an idea.
I guess that's true, where you have to – it's something gets in the way between the creative part of your brain and the part where the ideas come out. And if you spend so much time going, I don't know what to write about, then that's essentially what you're
creating. Also, I think the good thing is get yourself on the hook for it. You know, like take money from people and then be like forced to write. Otherwise, I think then you do pull like sort of a British Office or Flight of the Conchords where you're like, I don't know, we did it all, we're done. And I get that. Like, you do feel like you're done. I felt like I was done after season one of the show. We're like, well, that's all the ideas.
Boy, I always wonder if it's where I was over the weekend. I drove to Santa Barbara, and so I had the Sirius XM on, and I was listening to classic vinyl, and it was John Fogerty weekend. So John Fogerty basically picked a bunch of songs that he liked, and he was promoting some of his new stuff. And I wonder, you know, I was listening to it, and he was sort of talking about it like it was like the best stuff he had done in a long time. And you know, it was okay. It was all right.
Sure.
But I also, you know, you kind of get that thing where you go, when I get older, am I going to think I'm doing the best work I've ever done, but it's not really the best work I've ever done?
You should
done?
Always, like, it's like, that would really be a shitty feeling if you're like, it's like, it's all right. It's not like I used to do, though, because that's a real sad spot in your life if you're thinking that you weren't as good as you used to be.
No. Yeah. I know that, but I'm sure when he's listening to it, he's like, "This is the best stuff we've ever. Everything's really tight, and everything's really sounding great, and everything's really, mm-hmm. you know." But there's just some magical element about it that's not
time and place. Probably is that magical element.
You think
know?
So?
Like, yeah, I think that's a big part of it. Like, you know, all his music, all that sort of music of the '70s and you know, late '60s, early '70s was just like a great time for me. It's like hip hop, you know, like. It's very cool right now, I'm sure, to be Jay-Z, but like to like be NWA when they're first coming out, like be part of like a cultural movement.
That,
you know,
I think
like,
that I completely agree. Yeah, that the music was tied to something; it was about something. Yeah. And so when you hear, so like if you hear a Fogerty song now, you go, oh yeah, it's very technically proficient. It sounds really good. There's a little bit of a soul that's missing, and maybe that soul was the sort of cultural fabric that it was attached to. That's a really good point.
But instead of like singing about Vietnam, people are like, which war are you singing about? There's like three of them.
Singing about which one?
The secret one in South America?
Secret War? You got a Secret War song?
Secret War song?
Cool, let's hear that. Hold on. Yeah.
A lot of songs about the moon lately. it really was. I think the song was about a train or the moon or something.
Really, really. Yeah. Maybe he knows something about the moon we don't know. You know?
Moon train.
But if you think about it, you know, when you heard, you were probably, you know, young or like, you know, he was a young guy when he was making the Creedence songs and stuff like that. So, you know, you don't know what he's writing about now. He's an older guy. Maybe when you get to that age, you'll go, oh, yeah, trains, man. I get it.
It's possible. Yeah. You're absolutely right.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally
there's a lot possible. Of movies I watched as a kid that I thought I understood. And then when I had more life experience with, you know, relationships and family members dying and stuff like that, then you watch the, you know, those movies again. You're like, oh, that's why he couldn't get back together with her. There was too much emotional baggage between the two of them.
I watched Waiting for Guffman again last night for maybe the millionth time in my life. And have you ever seen that movie?
Of course. Right.
And it was the first time that I really picked up on, you know, how Bob Balaban plays a sort of uptight music teacher. Yeah. Well, I always loved the movie, but I never sort of kind of picked up on they were saying like he was really brilliant driven guy that everyone's sort of ignoring. They're ignoring him in rehearsals and like he wants to run the play. They never let him run the play. And then when you see his aspect of the job that he did in the show, it's like concert level quality, you know, it's like bassoon players and people in chimes and cymbals. And he has this whole sort of like orchestra going and it's like really efficient. And then I never really picked up on that.
That there was
a
difference between.
Yeah. That I like sort of now after writing so much, I see like, oh, that's what they were going for.
That's the joy in a movie like that is that it's so full of gems.
That's true.
That you could watch it 10 times and see a slightly different movie every single time depending on what you're
focusing. And I think also like just life experience, you can always go back and see movies. And
I like that. It's what's like the, I feel like those songs, I think Moon Train is the perfect example. Like, that's the perfect name of what that type of music is. Like, because you picture him describing it, and when you're younger, you can't figure out. He's like, well, Moon Train's all about taking a journey, and it's like, sometimes you feel you're going, and you're a young person going, what the fuck are you talking about, old man? Then you get older, and you're like, oh, Moon Train.
Yeah,
fucking
it's
moon
your
train.
Last thought before you die.
You know?
Oh, life is a Moon Train.
Getting on the Moon Train.
Yeah. Getting on the moon train.
I think you probably go, it's like a whole cycle. You start off saying, what the fuck is Moon Train about? And then you get a little older, like a late, you know, late teens, college age, and you're like, it's definitely about drugs, you know? and then you grow out of
about
that.
Loss.
Yeah, you grow out of that phase and you're like, what the fuck is Moon Train about? You know?
It's about family. And then
you're like, oh, I get it. Yeah, it's about loss and family. And then you're really old and you're like, I think it's about drugs again. And then you're like, what the fuck is Moon Train about? And then you die.
Well, that's why. And then you get on the moon train.
And that's then like, you're on the moon train. Then you're like, I get it.
And it's like you drop the snow globe that has a moon train in it.
Yep.
And you die.
And they go, next stop, moon train. And it's like the Twilight Zone episode of Willoughby where the guy keeps going to that really nice town and it turns out he died
now
on the train.
Now you get it,
Spoiler alert.
Fogerty's the conductor.
It is. Hop on the moon train. That is the perfect metaphor for what that is. And you, I guess you always, I think as a rock band, you should just write purposely cryptic lyrics because everyone will assign their. I guess if you ask Led Zeppelin about Stairway to Heaven, I think they're just like, well, it sounded cool, you know, to them. Everyone else is, oh, it's got this meaning.
Well, that was like every Kurt Cobain lyric. They were just like, what is he talking about? And then every story about them in the studio is just him going like, fuck, I got this time to put down lyrics.
They recorded Nevermind in like a week.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you find that people, I mean, Sonny is one of those shows that I'm sure people can watch the same way and see those really great ensemble casts where everyone is has a really strong point of view and is a really great performer. You really can watch and then just you can focus on a different character each time and just feel a different story.
I hope so. I mean, I think we have the sort of the opposite experience where we're constantly trying to lace it with like backstory and subtext and like social meaning and like sort of all these sort of like themes running throughout episodes, and people are like, dude, I love that moment where you fart really loud and then throw up. You know, like, I think it all goes missed. I don't know.
It's not the farts, what the fart represented.
Yeah.
It's all the not farts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's the negative space.
Right. Then we're in the editing room and we're like 12 minutes long. We're like, all right, cut out all the social reference and we'll get right to the point where I vomit.
The editor's like,
take out the commentary.
Just put the fart in. Cut out 12 minutes and put the fart in.
Fuck it.
Yeah.
Guys, we have 21 minutes of straight farts. Are you sure you don't want to go through?
Yeah.
And the Emmy goes too.
I know. Somebody else for a decade. For a decade. That's what it's been. That's what it is.
God, you guys were on. How long was Cheers on? Was it 9 or 10 years?
12 or 13.
I think 12.
Was it 12?
Yeah.
I mean, that's. Did it start in like 79? Did Cheers start in like 79?
82.
Well, then it couldn't have been 12 because I think the last season of Cheers. This is where Matt Myra would become very helpful because he knows every episode. I think it was 91 or 92. Okay, yeah, maybe 80 to 92.
I'm pretty sure it's 12 years.
God damn it.
Yeah. Katie, can we get a confirmation on that?
Started in
1982.
Oh, sorry, that's what I meant. And it ended in 1983.
11 years.
11 years.
So you guys are almost. You're almost Cheers.
Almost. Except they did like 22 episodes a year, and sometimes we're like, you guys want to do 7 or?
Well, stretch
this
out.
Let's keep it.
It'll
tight.
Take us just as long to do like a third of what they did.
But now, does that allow you more time? I mean, obviously, since you did Pacific Rim, you must have had a substantial chunk of time.
Yeah, it allows us a lot more time. A lot more time. It's a little tricky sometimes. Like right now, I haven't been in the editing room for a week. But the good thing about there being three of us is we can kind of pass it around. We just all have to be there for writing and shooting. But yeah, I guess with Pacific Rim, let's see. We'd finish the season. We just started later. Yeah, we just pushed our season a little later. And Caitlin Olsen had another baby, and I did Pacific Rim. And
Caitlin Olsen had another baby.
Just spitting them out. And we're like, we're not going to write this one in like we did the sixth season. That was really difficult. So I had time. I had time to do the movie.
Was it I imagine that working with Guillermo was probably an insane experience because he's just like a big kid.
It's unbelievable. He's like he's like a 12-year-old kid for sure. But he's
just discovered swearing.
Yeah. With a cartoon Mexican accent.
Yes.
You know, he loves to talk about like swears and dicks and butts. He's so incredibly talented. He's incredibly talented. He's so much smarter than anyone I've ever worked with.
I'm wondering, so when you work with Guillermo, do you go back to Sonny and you're like, guys, I have all these crazy ideas. Just like working.
I go back and I'm like, guys, we are all so dumb. We're so dumb. He's read everything. And I don't mean like a lot of stuff. I mean everything, all the books, everyone. We stole like a bunch of his camera moves and like we did a Halloween episode and it was supposed to be a little darker and moodier. And Guillermo actually did a little guest appearance in this was in the eighth season. And we shot it like we would shoot a regular episode, but I also did sort of Guillermo takes where I was like, guys, okay, now I just want to get one take where the camera's slowly spinning, then pushes in on this guy here. Like, cause his staging camera work is just mind-boggling and beautiful. Mm-hmm. There's actually one sequence in the movie where I get knocked to the ground and my glasses fall off and I'm scrambling to find them, and he built like a giant pair of glasses, you know, like Hitchcock style, and put them in front of the camera.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. And I'm like pretending to find these things which are bigger than my living room couch, and I saw the shot. It's like 2 seconds in the movie, But the glasses are big in the frame, and I'm big in the frame. He was filled with like tricks and moves like that. Just a guy who understands cinema and knows what he's doing. And wow. And look, I know I'm certainly like promoting the movie, but I saw it in. I kind of wish I wasn't in it so I could tell people how awesome it is.
Oh, because no one's going to believe
me? No, no one's going to believe me. And, yeah.
Oh, sure, your movie's great. Yeah, like Fogerty's album.
Yeah.
No, right. No, this is my moon train.
This is my moon train, people. But I saw it in London, and I'd seen like rough assemblies, and I was like, oh, this is going to be fun. It's going to be big. But I saw it in London, and like... I like cried. Like there was like a moment in the movie where I got choked up. I was terrified. I was thrilled. I was laughing. And I haven't felt that way. I hate that this is my I hate talking about my own movie like this, but like I haven't felt this way since like Jurassic Park.
Let's pretend you're not in it. Let's pretend it's Aaron Paul because we're all interchangeable
white
guys.
Aaron Paul. Yeah. Love Aaron Paul. Okay. Yeah. I wish Aaron Paul was in it. it's just so fun. Just like I personally aside from Pan's, which is just like this perfect little art movie, Pan's Labyrinth, this is my favorite Guillermo movie.
Oh wow,
yeah, I feel like he's just getting better and better at what he's doing.
Well, he used to, you know, I think one of it'll be really exciting to see him what he does because I'm going to the thing tomorrow night.
So, oh great,
to see what he does with an actual huge budget film because
yeah.
So much of what he's done in a lot of his career is. To basically do high budget, low budget movies,
right? Yeah,
where it's like he doesn't have a ton of money, but it's so immersive and
yeah,
it
like
looks
the Hellboys, he had like the same budget we had for say Horrible Bosses, but he made it look like a giant action movie,
exactly and, with tons of creatures, and so to see him be able to essentially scale up like that.
Yeah,
I'm really, really excited about it. If it were anyone else, I might be like, oh, I don't know about this, but
I know
it's Guillermo.
You know, this has been such a weird, like the marketing campaign doesn't do this movie any justice, which is because it's real. You can't capture the scale of what this movie is.
Well, it's
on your home TV.
It's such a new. I mean, like the kaiju movie is obviously not new, but the idea of what it is, like this story is. I'm sure the marketing department's probably like. How do we? I mean, it's all new IP.
Yeah.
It's all new. There's no recognizable anything in it other than giant monsters and giant robots. So they must be like, well, because there's just basically giant monster robot posters all over town.
Yeah, which look, that's it. You know, it's definitely a giant robot monster movie, but it works. And that's the thing. You don't expect it to work. You see the poster, you're like, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. But if someone told you, no, it's going to be. A crazy ride, and you're gonna want to like cheer and clap and like throw your popcorn at the screen. And, like, it's tough. I feel like the only way to really have commercials for that is to drag everyone to like an IMAX and say go watch it there. But
I envision you going back to the sunny writers room and be like, guys, we need robots.
Yeah,
we need to build. To defeat a DeVito, we created a DeVito. You build like a Danny DeVito robot, and he has to fight himself.
See, our problem is we have the opposite problem. We take a cheap show, and I think we make it look cheaper. Somehow, we really botch that up every year.
How do you start to at this point? Is it sort of you know the character so well? Everyone knows their character so well. So does it actually make the writing process? A bit easier because it's pretty.
It does, but that's scary. Like we wrote the season really fast this year, which freaked me out because I'm always like, well, this must be lazy. We did it wrong, and it's tough to tell. It's such a subjective business. It's so impossible to know when we've written a script and we're like, yes, this is the best thing we've written, and then we, you know, by the time we acted and cut it together, we're like, it's not my favorite, and then it's sort of the one you. Whipped together without any thought as quickly as possible that you're like, oh, that works. It's great.
Yeah.
It's really, I don't know. If there was an actual mathematical formula to it, someone would have figured that out by now, but it's this sort of intangible thing where you just start like throwing paint at a wall and sometimes it works great. And then right when you think you know exactly how to throw paint at a wall, like you miss and you hit the door or whatever. I don't know. That's a really stupid metaphor.
No.
Fine.
But
there is no spoon.
There is no spoon, people.
Yeah.
I don't. Was there a question, or am I just rambling about?
We're talking about the idea, and you sort of you hit an interesting point, particularly with comedy, where it's, you know, you try to over-engineer something.
Yeah.
Like, okay, that's all right. And then the one time you're like, oh, you don't think about it. It just like you just capture the lightning for a second in the bottle. You're like, where did that come from? Like, you know, those parts of your brain that you're not aware are active just make a thing happen.
Yeah, and it's like this one little sort of DNA strand that keeps you from like being Brad Pitt of an episode, or like Brad Pitt's like squirrely looking brother or whatever. Like, I don't know if he does have one or not, but like it's the same.
Josh Pitt.
Yeah,
say,
whatever it is.
Like, still sounds like a hot guy.
Yeah, he's Josh Pitt's probably fine.
Yeah.
But it's a fine line. Like, even like with Pacific Rim, when I was in the editing room looking at the rough cut, I'm like, yeah, I don't know. I don't think it's going to work. And then when I was in London, I saw it. I'm like, this is the greatest movie of all time. Or with an episode of Sunny where I'm like, ah, gosh, I don't know. And then we find like some sort of like musical theme. We're like, no, wait, it's all coming together.
Yeah.
It's this really tough thing to nail down.
You're right, an episode. Oh, you go.
Oh, no. But that's always such a weird thing where you're, you know, you think something's funny and then you shoot it. And then you'd have a first pass in editing. You're like, oh, we fucked up. No, this is unsalvageable. Yeah. This is the fucking worst. And then, like, it's like, yeah, just like you said, there's like one thing and then it just kind of starts stitching everything together.
Just a
like,
little this, like, manipulating.
Yeah.
The first time in an editing room, I always want to die.
Devastating.
Every episode since the beginning of the show. Oh, God. I remember the very first time we saw an episode and we're like, we suck. We are the most unfunny, untalented, unoriginal, you know. But like we had this like editor we didn't know that well. He put like record scratches in the cut, you know, like
oh, no.
Yeah, just like
no. Dog reactions. Where'd you get the footage of the dog?
Yeah.
I used to have this really old bit because I fucking hated the record scratch, and they would use it all the time in commercials for sitcoms. They're like, guess who's dropping by Sunday night? Hey guys, what a joop whoop joop. And then it was that weird that I was like, it's such an outmoded form of technology.
Yeah.
So I'd always wanted to throw in an Alpenhorn right there where someone would say something and go, hey guys, I brought the dogs. And then I would just try to go. I would go for like a minute straight, because it seems like if you're gonna like, there people don't have jukeboxes anymore, where you go in and bump into it because something crazy happened and it skips the record. That doesn't happen
anymore.
Just,
there's the record scratch is a thing of the past. Really,
You choke the editor or fire him, or were you able to?
You know, we were all so like devastated we couldn't even pinpoint at yet like what it was.
Everyone's blaming themselves.
Yeah, and it was us too. We hadn't perfected it, but we were able to cut it together to make it okay. But yeah, it's devastating.
Yeah.
Well, and also, when you're in an editing room and you think it's, and then someone just has one idea. Oh, you know, actually, I remember we have a shot from another thing.
Right.
I wonder if I just drop this in here, all of a sudden it's magically elevated. Like those moments are, you get addicted to those moments.
I wonder what it's like to watch The Godfather without that like theme music. You know, if you're like, this is the most boring, like slow. And you've seen that when people like recut. Have you seen the recut of The Shining? There's a great like YouTube video. Yeah,
that one.
Shining
with Salisbury Hill.
Yeah, Salisbury Hill. Yeah. Playing Salisbury Hill.
That contest,
I'm your new foster father.
Climbing up on Salisbury
Hill. I watch that thing nonstop. All the recut trailers are my fucking favorite things.
Yeah, you live and die by that editor.
Yeah.
Like you really, he or she can make you.
That's what's so scary about it, though, is you come back with all this footage.
Yeah,
and there are an infinite number of combinations that you could put things together and get a result.
Yeah.
And most of them are not going to be good. And there's a handful that are good. And it's just trying to find the David inside the marble.
Basically. Is that what happened?
Yeah.
It was already in there.
He's like, let me just get into this marble. Holy shit, there's a good...
I think that's what he... Isn't that what he said? That it was all about freeing the object.
He
that
saw what it was in there. He just had to like get...
He just had to release it.
I wonder... there's a grape leaf on his...
I don't think it's an overstatement to say we do the exact same thing, right? I mean... I mean, it's literally the exact same thing, right, guys?
It is.
Yeah.
It's that important.
Mm-hmm. It is.
It's that good. And I really feel like, you know, particularly podcasts will stand the test of the ages.
I think, yeah, we'll they will lives. Be carved out of digital stone one day. Yeah,
the bummer
yeah.
part is that at least, you know, at least artists of yesteryear expressed in media that would last, you know, in 100 years or 200 years. Yeah. If there are no disc players anymore, if there's no, you know, if the internet's changed, if file formats are different, you know, like everything, all the stuff we're doing is just is gone. It's disposable.
You know what will last?
You're props. On the cloud.
Props.
Props.
Prop comedy will last.
Prop comedy will last.
When all digital media has gone away, prop comedy will still be there.
Who's laughing now in the apocalypse of the prop comic?
Is there another prop comic other than Carrot Top? Is he the only guy? That's all I can think of.
There are.
It's gotta be.
There are prop comics.
Jeff Dunham's gonna do well.
Oh, don't say that. Yeah, I don't know. I feel like it's prop comedy is not as popular as it once was.
There's got to be.
As
it's
it
not
could
like,
be?
It's not like he showed up. Everyone's like, well, he did it. And then just,
better just put, take my steam yeah. trunk and throw it off a bridge.
Yeah.
Did you ever want to do stand-up?
No. God, no.
No.
No. Terrifying. Can you imagine?
That'd be awesome. You're like, disgusting. I hate the people that do it.
Yeah. It's a horrible medium.
The idea of it.
No, it's terrifying to me. Usually they are very sort of bitter, angry people. I feel like a lot of like stand-ups are like really angry people. That world is angrier than I want to be involved in. But I was like a theater guy. I wanted to be. I wanted to be like Al Pacino, and then I just realized I look and sound crazy funny, and I should just embrace that.
Charlie,
he got
Day
there too. He got there too.
In, yeah,
he
Dog turned into Day crazy Afternoon.
Yeah, I would
hey
been
guys.
Great. I would have been great. He sounds like me in Dog Day Afternoon.
It is a little bit
like a high pitched thing. You know? Yeah.
Do you have a when you're performing? Do you sort of go to a place, and if it feels really familiar, you're like, oh no, I'm a character of what I thought I was. Do you feel like, do you have a performance mode, or is you pretty?
No, I check out. You know, like I think it'd be pretty awful to be in your head about yourself while you're doing it. So it's, I think I'm trying to just believe what I'm saying in the moment. And then I let someone else have opinions about
what
it, but I try not to have any personal opinions about it.
What do you do for fun? I mean, you have a small child.
Yeah. I don't have fun anymore. I mean, like I just, like, I work and I change diapers. I mean, that's kind of it.
Is there anything else you want to do, like in terms of? Oh, I think I'll start your fam. I read about your family's musical.
Yeah, but I don't want to be one of those people who's like, now I have an album, not that you can't do that, but for some reason it's always a little bit like, I don't know. You get like if you get this far, I'm lucky enough to get this far in one profession. Like I don't want to be greedy and be like. I'm also.
You don't want to. You don't want to release. My Girl Wants to Party All the Time.
Yeah, well, if I could write something that good.
Yeah, but at the same time, like Jason Schwartzman's Coconut Records albums are really good.
I'm sure they are.
They're really good.
But he started as a musician.
That's true.
Acting was his sort of. He tripped over acting.
Hey, you know those She and Him records? Not so bad either.
No, they're good.
Good. See, so maybe it's my own sort of insecurity about it.
There's another guy too. I think the band's called Dead Man's Bones or something like that. But it's an actor, not Gyllenhaal, but
Dogstar,
Ryan Gosling. Is that his band?
Yeah,
he was like, I think he's in a band called like Dead Man's Bones or something like that, and it's fucking like really interesting and good. Yeah,
I think now is a time where
you can do it.
You and I grew up at a time where everyone was very segmented. TV people did TV, film people did film, music people did music, and whenever there people start to cross over, like, hey, what are you doing there? You know.
Yeah, for me,
now everyone does everything.
Yeah, that whole sort of phase where it was like Billy Bob was like, all right, well now I'm only going to do country music, and you're like, oh come on, man, like I love you in movies.
Yeah,
like why are you going to do
Bad Santa too?
But like, and then Zooey Deschanel is like, well, I have adorkable albums too, and it's like, and you know, that's my own baggage because they're actually like both great at music and good. So I don't know why I'm like, meh.
But you never know if you're going to be, you know, Dogstar or the Bacon Brothers or you know, anything like that.
Well, but also, look, in my defense, I have absolutely no desire to start a band.
See, that's the thing.
You're starting a band now. We've already said it was
Guys,
okay.
Don't make me do this.
Here we are.
I don't want to.
Here's your, a jug. Start
your,
with that.
Your band's going to be called Hard Day's Night. The theme is that you show, you dress in medieval songs from the point of view of a guy who's preparing for a joust.
Now, see, that I would do. That that interests me more, actually.
That's a great concept, though.
Yeah. It's be a really good concept album. I think it's like the upper crust is one of I fucking love the upper
crust. Oh, the upper crust are great.
Do you remember the upper crust?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just like guys who play AC/DC music from the point of view of fops.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's and they fucking dress up. Like that to me would be a fun way. Because I think particularly as a comedian, there's no real way to do serious music without people like I think that's the one part.
Yeah,
where
that's the other thing too. Like, if you're already like if you've been too funny, then people won't accept it.
It's hard enough to watch a comedian. It can be challenging enough to watch them make the jump to to do a dramatic role. Much less like
Sing love song. Like, you really gonna go see Will Ferrell like sing like ballads?
Yeah. Although that's the one. That's the one guy that if he did it, I'd probably be like, well, I'll take whatever he's serving. I don't.
Well, see, that's good. Yeah. Was he on insecurities?
When did you host SNL? Was it 08 or 09?
No, it was later than that. 11, I think 2011.
Oh, it was just a couple
November
years ago.
2011. Yeah.
Was it a pants shitting experience or was it pretty much?
No, because I knew that it would be, and so like I trained my mind like an athlete to like really make sure I wasn't nervous. So and it was sort of just like this trick I do where if I get that like tingling nervous sensation, I have to sort of translate that into, oh, you're a kid on Christmas morning who's super excited to do this thing and you can't wait to open this present, as opposed to it's the fight or flight thing, as opposed to saying, you're going to throw up and fail. Oh, and
that's
so,
such a much – I never thought to do that before. That's so much better than the, I'm going to fuck this up, I'm going to fuck this up.
Like, yeah. It's like it was life-saving. In fact, when Sudeikis and I were promoting Horrible Bosses, he showed me an email from Lorne Michaels to Sudeikis saying, do you know Charlie? Is he a good guy? Would he ever want to host? And I started to shit my pants, you know? And I was like – my first instinct was no. And then I realized – I'm going to have to work hard on my head if I'm ever going to do this. And you know what? I had like the best week of my life, constantly telling myself it's a party. I'm so happy to be here. I'm having fun. You know, the fans of Sonny or whatever want to see me here, which is great. People just want to laugh. It's SNL. So some sketches will be great. Some will suck no matter what. And that's just what it is. So don't worry about that. And it was like the best sort of acting experience of my life. So fun.
Yeah.
Magical place to be. Wait, I want to take this back to stand-up. Have you ever done stand-up? Do you do stand-up?
Oh, yeah. I've been doing stand-up for like 15 years.
All the time, right?
Yeah.
And you do as well?
Yeah.
Do you guys like it? Do you hate it?
Are
stand-ups angry?
You don't hate it.
I've been quitting since the day I started.
No. It's my favorite thing in the world. And the only reason that I still do it, because I really don't have time to do it, but I still... Because I pretty much work every day, and then every weekend that I'm available, I'm performing somewhere. That's why I was in Philly.
That's right.
I was performing at Helium in Philly, and it's my absolute favorite thing in the world.
Well, because you get that audience interaction, and it's a big rush.
But also, stand-up for me was, you know, my young life had a couple – there were a couple of sectors of influence, and one was – you know, video games and chess club, and then the other thing was like – stand-up. Like, I just had every stand-up album, every stand-up everything. It was like my obsession from, you know, the first time I saw Steve Martin on Saturday Night Live in the late 70s.
The crazy part about it is, though, it doesn't get easier. It's, you know, I always used to think that, like, oh, once I had a TV spot, or once I was on a late-night show, or once I did a half hour, and I've done all those things. I've done, like, you know, a lot of it on TV, but it's still like it just gives me more anxiety. Like, the more I do, the more like I fucking freak out about it and get real weird. It doesn't stop.
Not me.
It doesn't stop.
I mean, it can be anxiety inducing, but I also feel like, now we're just talking about ourselves. I'm sorry.
No, but that's I asked.
Yeah. But okay, but what's happened is that since I did an hour special that aired last year, and then I had to start all over again with material. So I basically went on the road again in November with 12 minutes of material, but I had to fill an hour. So it was basically just riffing and fucking around with the audience. And it's been so much fun to form the hour that way, because it's every show is a slightly different experience and a new sort of opportunity to like, oh, I'll come up with bits and I'll get to. I love the process of it so much. I fucking love it so much.
See, that's great. And then some people always ask me about stand-up, and it's a different thing. You have to train. You have to learn it. You have to love it. You have to do it for years and years to get good at
really
it.
It's really not rewarding for a long time, other than just that you're getting up and doing it. It's not. A lot of times you're like, so am I going to tour? What's going to happen? Am I going to make money doing this?
Right.
You know, so it can be a little, you know.
And we're all sitting here talking together, and you're all realizing now that I'm painfully unfunny in real life. This is this is
like, made me laugh several times.
I'm an extremely serious person.
This is, this has really turned into like an NPR interview.
Good.
No, not at all. Are you doing the saxophone?
Just any kind of weird, sad dissonance.
Today our guest is Charlie Day of the hilarious television.
Oh, see, you have a good NPR voice.
Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Actually, no, that's a terrible. They have
weird voices.
Yeah. It's always like
the business of business.
Daniel Shore. Today's stock market was awful, and
You have to turn the radio because of the amount of spittle.
Blood was everywhere in the streets of Tehran.
I had seven seizures this morning on the way to work.
Today on Card Catalog, we're going to be discussing the reference section of the New York Public Library.
Bookworm.
Bookworm.
A guy that did a cartoon bookworm.
And then there's Sandra Singh Lowe with the Lowdown on Science. Have you ever heard her? Like, Wackily Warblers, and she always goes like, and gets her microphone, like her, as if the air in the room is coming directly from the microphone.
That's her oxygen, Dave.
Yeah,
like,
straight into it. Oh, well.
There's a couple, they really are an insane cast of characters that I feel like, if you were gonna make a visualization of NPR as a group, they would just be like Muppets. They would just be these crazy Muppets.
Yeah.
They basically just feels like it was like the studio next to the Muppet Show studio were basically these radio Muppets.
Right. Yeah.
And NPR is what they can. National
Radio
Puppet
Muppets,
Radio. National Puppet
Radio. I think you just launched a show, or this is an idea here.
Yeah.
Radio Muppets is perfect, you guys. We don't even have to build puppets.
There it is.
It's just the voices.
No one will know.
No one. Wow, you're crazy looking. Anyway.
Yeah. Most radio people do look like radio Muppets, by the way.
I bet. That's why they're in radio.
They really, well, it's actually the engineers. I worked in radio for like three or four years, and every sound engineer is just like a beautifully strange creature that almost kind of looks like Sweetums. You know, the big walk-around Muppet who's like, hey, guys, wait for me. You know, like, that's what a lot of the sound engineers
look
like.
Do you think that's, like, is it because they're never in light and they're always in a dark room? Or do they find a dark room and they run from the light?
Well, I think it's a sort of a symbiotic relationship they form with the darkness.
But wait, then how did Seacrest turn out so good-looking?
Well, because he's not an engineer. He's a personality.
But he started as an engineer.
Oh, did he start as an engineer? I don't know. I don't know if he was always, like, he, you know, you see the picture, like, there was a picture of him posted. Where he was just like a chubby kid, and I think he
a lot of hard work to get that look.
You know, they found the David inside of Ryan.
That's right. They chipped away.
They chipped away, and there it was, you guys.
And they got the full Seacrest in there.
Hey, buddy, been here all along.
Talk about a guy who works hard. Oh my God.
Yeah, and it's not even just that he works hard. I mean, like I have a handful of jobs, but his handful of jobs, any one of could sustain. I mean, like
a small country.
Every job of his is worth like $50 million.
He would
a piece.
Not relate to the Flight of Conchords guys.
Well, you gotta keep working.
Who was it?
Our friends Brad and Boyd were like writer producers on his morning show once, and they interviewed Tim Ferriss, who had the 4-hour work week. An idea of just like having like a kind of job set up to where you had so much free time you can go on trips and you didn't really.
This
have
is basically
to, be an
to condense your workflow into a really organized, streamlined, basically autopilot kind
That's
of
awesome.
Workflow.
Yeah, and so he's like, so with this way of doing the 4-hour work week is that you'll have time for yourself. And then Seacrest's reaction was just like, hey, you got another jab? No. The idea is to just have time
so
for
if I can
family.
Fill it, if I can fill it with 10 4-hour jobs, it's like a 40-hour work week.
Yeah.
No, that's what I do, too. Are you that way?
Yeah, probably a little bit, yeah. I don't want to be. And now that I have a kid, I really don't want to be. But I am doing too many things.
But there is a certain amount of moxie that you have to say, hey, let's get our friends together and actually cut it, like make a thing before there's really a YouTube, because then you're just like, what are we going to do? Just hand the tape around? Like, it really was just a, oh, we'll just hand the tape around, I guess. We'll just pass it
around.
That's
kind of how I saw Foot Fist Way for the first time. It was just like,
hey, the Denim and Bride thing? Yeah. Me too.
That was sort of a fun way to discover things. Now it's so, you know, you just take it so for granted. Like, oh, send me a link.
Yeah. And then you can only last for like 4 minutes or something.
Yes.
It's like it's like sex.
I clicked away. He said something about ducks, and so I went to Wikipedia and started looking up mallards. Like, right. It's just like we're so distracted at all times.
I was trying to remember how I survived before a cell phone. Like before cell phone and email and any of that stuff. First of all, how do people make movies? That's crazy to me.
Yeah, how did stuff get done?
How did anything get done?
Yeah.
If you go and look at old houses, maybe going back to the Philadelphia comment, but when you look at the old houses, it's just like the bedrooms were tiny because you didn't have to put media centers in them, and all the rooms were very small because they were just supposed to hold like two people.
Well, they're also supposed to hold heat.
They were supposed to hold heat, like, and a couple people.
Yeah.
And then you look around at the bedroom like, what did people do when they laid in bed at night? How did they distract themselves? I don't know. Books?
Sleep? Probably sleep.
I'm guessing sleep. Yeah.
Yeah, probably not just putting a beam of light and information into their fucking face before they fall asleep and have to rest their brain.
No, really, but there was a period of time where, hey, it's dark now. Now it is time for sleep. Here comes the sun. Yeah. It is time to get up to sustain our little farm ship so that we don't die.
Right. Let's get into our little room because we need that fire warmth to reach us. You know, the big cavernous room is freezing.
I've forgotten how to wait. Like, if I don't have a phone, I don't know how to wait and, like,
you just start shuffling your arms?
Yeah, I just don't know what to do.
Yeah.
Like, it's like my friend was picking me up. I went outside of my house and I was just like, oh, I forgot my phone. Ah, we're just getting lunch. Where the fuck is he? Like, just like, I fucking didn't know what to do.
You're just running up to people like a fucking...
Yeah. Tell me something. Tell me a quip. Just keep it under 140 characters, please.
Sir, give me information. Yeah. What do you know about things? What's
happening? I made a square with my hands. I started looking at trees and sunsets. Those are good grams.
Did you just poke yourself in the eye to create a filter? I got a runny filter. That's where you start writing graffiti on bathroom walls because you just have to fucking...
Is anything trending on this bathroom wall? What's trending?
Looks like shit.
It is weird to, you know, when you this I'm really ashamed to admit this, but you know, when you're flying overseas, there's no internet, and so you kind of have that thing of like, what am I going to do? Well, there's an entertainment system. You can watch a ton of movies, but I'm not directly connected to people. Well, you're sitting around 300 other people, anyone whom you could talk to. I don't want to talk to people face to face.
It's a 10-hour flight. Nobody wants you, engaging just in case you're in trouble.
You're just trying to create a social network on the plane.
Yeah.
You can do that on Virgin flights. That.
Yeah, you can do that on Virgin flights.
I don't know why you want to.
Have you ever used the Virgin seat-to-seat messaging system before?
I think it would be creepy.
Wouldn't it be creepy?
I think it's creepy to do that. It seems like it's like if you're on like a volleyball team or in a band and you're going on a same flight, that might be fun for a second. But
just to a stranger, that's pretty creepy.
Hey, hot stuff, want some pretzels? No, please don't ever communicate with me again.
Meet me near the shitter.
Well, your first mistake was saying shitter. I don't know how romantic that is.
Depends who you ask.
Your second mistake is that you're married, and why are you flirting with this woman on a plane, Jonah?
I'm not flirting with her. I'm just having fun.
That's where this fantasy started going today.
Exactly.
Meet me near the shitter.
I like to sleep on a plane, personally.
Me too.
I can't sleep on a plane.
Oh, so
I'm gigantic, and it just nothing
fits you.
Nothing fits.
See, I'm like you put me in the glove box. And
just overhead bin.
Honestly, that'd be great. Like I like a cozy nook if I could get tossed.
They just stuff you under the seat.
Yeah.
I'm fine down here. I can fit under the seat. It's fine. Yeah.
I just flew in from London, and my trick for sleeping was staying up the entire night, which I haven't done in a long time.
Gets harder.
It got really hard.
Yeah.
Got really hard.
You think it's a good idea. It makes logical sense. And then you do it and the chemicals in your body do not appreciate it.
Yeah. Right around the time where we're waiting in the, in the lobby to board the plane and, you know, the alcohol's wearing off from the good times, it started to feel like a real bad idea. But then I passed out the whole way.
Did you really?
Yeah. And now I'm back on California time. I think I did my body a good service here.
I tried last time I flew to England. I was like, I had that plan. I was like, I'm going to have some drinks. and then I'm going to take like half of like a Xanax, and I'm just going to conk out. And like I just felt like shit the entire time because my body wanted to sleep, couldn't get comfortable to sleep. So it was just groggy and psychotic feeling the entire time. Watched a lot of movies, though.
That's a gamble. First of all,
mixing alcohol and benzodiazepines are a really hot idea.
I said Xanax, Chris. Yeah. That's a net alert.
That's probably why you're typing, hey, let's meet near the shitter, because you're loaded on fucking pills and booze.
Yeah.
It doesn't. Were you just in this sort of weird haze where you were so fucked up your body couldn't go to sleep?
Yeah, I felt sore the entire time. I just felt out of it and just like, I felt like I had a head cold pretty much.
Yeah, that's not good.
No, it wasn't.
And you're also a big guy, so I would almost imagine you would have to, it would almost taste like a horse tranquilizer to knock you out.
It does, every night.
You okay?
Don't touch me.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Maybe near the shitter.
I made a deal with myself years ago where I said I have to fly a lot. I don't like flying. I'm going to get over it, and I'm going to learn to sleep on planes. And now I fucking, the second I get on a plane and I kind of just hear the ambient hum, my eyes get heavy.
Me too. I need that. In fact, I look forward to long plane rides like, oh, finally I'm going to get some sleep.
Yeah, for me it's more just I take that as an opportunity to catch up on a ton of movies.
What did you watch?
Which is, what?
What did you watch on the flight over to England when you guys went to England?
Oh, fuck. I mean, like, in total, I watched, like, 10 movies.
Are you serious?
Yeah, but one of the best things I watched was a special from Steve Coogan. What's the character he did?
I'm Alan Partridge.
Alan Partridge, but it was like Alan Partridge self-serving, I'm going to show you where I live, the town, the hamlet I'm from. And it was like one of the, like, I couldn't stop, like, laughing at it the entire time.
That's,
I'm glad. Well, yeah, like,
what was a good movie? You can't name one? You watched 10.
I watched 10. It was a few months ago.
Remember, he was on Xanax and alcohol.
That's true. He was whacked out of his brain.
That was for the flight home. I watched, like, you know, what did I fucking
He was probably asleep the whole time thinking he was dreaming of movies.
I watched Tintin for 10 hours.
He's just mashing up all these. I was called Lars and all the real girls just want to have fun.
Fuck, I can't remember what I watched. I watched a lot of movies.
It's about a group of blow-up dolls who go on spring break.
Yeah.
Seriously can't remember one movie?
I named one thing I watched.
You did name a
you
thing.
Did.
That's true.
But I was excited to talk about the movie, man. What did I watch on a flight? Here, I'll help you. I flew to Canada a year ago, and I watched Drive on a plane.
I've seen that.
Loved it.
Oh, got another Gosling joint.
Another Gosling movie. Yeah, a good plane ride movie. Yeah.
I don't really
good
watch...
LA movie too.
Very good LA movie.
When it shows, like, I like it when a movie shows LA and like from a different angle.
Yeah,
it was all that like MacArthur Park area and, you know, downtown, the river, stuff like that. It was nice.
I don't really watch a lot of movies on planes because it's hard. Even on a plane, it's hard for me to focus for a couple hours. I'll watch like a Mad Men episode or a Louis episode on the iPad.
Cloud Atlas was one of the movies I watched.
There you go.
Cloud Atlas. Great plane movie.
Yeah.
I don't know about sitting in a theater for it, but like a great plane movie because it's segmented and it's long and it takes up a lot of time.
Yeah, that's true.
Are they showing, do they have Sunny episodes on?
I don't know. Sometimes, like, I've caught it on JetBlue, but only because it was on FX.
So you obviously have to sit there and watch and laugh extra loud at the episode for everyone.
Who are these hilarious people?
How do they come up with this stuff?
Come, look, look.
Join me in row 2.
Channel 27.
Let's get a social chat going about this. No, I rarely see Sonny anywhere. It's part of the conspiracy against us, I think. I don't know. It's hard to find.
But it still has people still watch the shit out of the show. Like, your fans are pretty...
They find it. They've kept us alive, despite the airlines.
Who are clearly in a conspiracy together. Yeah. Like, okay, we need to get fuel prices down, and we really need to try to tank Sonny.
There's probably some executive who's like, all right, well, give me a couple episode titles of Charlie Got Molested and, maybe not this one. Sweet Tea Dates a Retarded Person. I'm like, I don't know.
That's really fun.
Yeah, I don't see, like, South Park on planes either. There's certain things that they shy away from.
Yeah, I guess that's true. But at least, most people watch stuff on their devices anyway, so I guess it doesn't even really matter.
I watched Flight.
Oh, on a plane.
As we were taking off the accident part started to happen.
Shoot.
It was like fucking being in like rumble boxes.
You kind of feel like maybe they shouldn't put those movies.
There was a disclaimer. Just to let you know, this has a Horrible plane accident.
Well, that's actually good.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But it was neat because it's like as we were taking off, we were hitting a lot of turbulence going out of Heathrow. And it was just as the plane was shaking, the plane started shaking in the movie.
So it was like being on Star Tours.
You said that's neat.
Like, well, it was frightening.
Like, that's the experience you're going for. Like, this is neat.
Yeah, it's neat.
Yeah,
it's
dying. I could die.
Yeah, it's just fun. It's fun. It was like it was a 360 experience.
That's really cool.
Yeah, you're a braver man than I am.
Yeah, and then I popped on Fearless.
Just a bunch of Crash movies.
Yeah, exactly. Crash.
But he lives in Fearless. He lives.
Yeah, exactly.
So, oh, he's coming up.
Mm.
We did Jeff Bridges.
Jeff Bridges soon.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we got didn't even talk about Fearless.
No.
He must have talked about Lebowski, right?
Yeah.
He is basically Lebowski. He's
the
dude.
Yeah, right, he is?
Yeah. Just like right when he walked in, hey, man.
who have you met that you were... Oh, we talked about this before. You don't really get nervous meeting people.
Not nervous, no. I mean, I would be excited to meet him.
But you seem like a pretty... from what I could tell, the couple times that we've hung out in a short burst, you seem like a pretty well-adjusted, calm person. Like, you don't have the comic... that energy of like notice me or I want people to like me. You're like, you know, whatever.
I learned at a very young age that people weren't going to notice and or like me, so I stopped seeking that approval a long time ago. I don't know. I like well, thanks, I guess. Yeah, I'm calm,
but it is always nice to meet funny people who, because I think we're just used to being around like that. We all sort of have that comic. I mean, it is a weird thing to get up in front of a room full of strangers and be like me, like what I'm saying. I want you to like, I want you to laugh. I want you to laugh at me. You know, like that's a very weird thing to do.
Terrifying thing. I can't imagine.
Sad, really.
when you really strip
it away.
When they
don't laugh, I bet it's the saddest day of your life. Yeah, yeah.
That's just when you yell at him, what's wrong with you, baby?
Presenting you with funny ideas. Show me that you accept them and me.
You wouldn't know art if it came in you. And then you fucking throw the mic down and whoong.
Right.
And
who's art?
I don't.
Yeah.
And then you're on stage 4 minutes.
No, I have a much more calculated way of getting people to like me. Like, no, that's not the take. Let me just readjust this.
Exactly.
Now I'm lovable.
But you're one of those guys that people want to see more of, like okay, yeah, they like you from Sunny, and then Horrible Bosses. All right, it's like you've passed. You know, every performer sort of has a series of hurdles that they have, or like tests that they get through. Like someone might be really funny on TV, and they do like a crappy movie, and people are like, I thought, never mind.
Right.
But it's like you've passed the hurdles, and now you've done this big action movie, and it's like, I think it's going to be good.
Yeah, or the big action movie will end me once and for all. And
it's not at all.
Again.
Listen, even if Pacific Rim tanks, which I don't think it's going to, it's certainly not going to be your responsibility.
No, it's not really. It wasn't my doing.
Yeah. No, that wouldn't matter. You still get to be in a really cool, big-budget Guillermo action movie.
Yeah, and I feel good about it. Like, even if it tanks, my opinion of the film is good. Like, I think that matters to me more.
What other stuff are you? Or is there other stuff that you've shot that's coming out too?
No. That's a big part of it too. Is I don't think I've really oversaturated people with myself, which I think happens. Like even the brilliant and talented Melissa McCarthy, you know, who let's face it, she's so funny and so good, is everywhere to the point where I'm like, I don't know, she's in a movie again.
It's tough because you and that part is probably not as much in her control. It's just like, you know, you spend so much time trying to get work, and all of a sudden people are like, here's a bunch of work. You can do whatever you want. And then you're like, okay. And then it all comes out at the same time.
Right. And you sort of have to do it. Maybe you shot the two things years apart, but they come out at the same time.
Right.
No. You know, it's tough to know.
Like John Heder. Like, you know, there was Napoleon Dynamite, and then he did...
John Heder.
He did 5-6 movies in a row because he was the new comedy star, and then they all just came out in a sequence and just people liked them less and less.
Yeah.
And then there was just nothing for a while.
Yeah. Of course, you do have to get a performance in those movies that at least lives up to Napoleon Dynamite.
Well, it's just that
that's
such a specific character. Like, that's such a specific thing.
I know, yeah.
And then, you know, it's almost like the... It's
well, that's the thing too. I guess you got to pick good things. Like if you do 10 in a row and they don't give you the opportunity to be as funny as you were in, say, like Napoleon Dynamite, where he was hysterical.
Yeah,
you know, that's
but audiences think very one dimensionally, and they have to be I think they have to sort of be trained a little bit in the sense where in his next movie, people go in with Napoleon Dynamite in their head and they go, oh, he's not. He's just a guy. He's just being a guy. He's not doing a crazy.
But he kind of sounds like Napoleon Dynamite.
But he's not Napoleon. You know, it's like you.
And some of it's luck, too. I mean, it really is. I was up for this other movie, and I really wanted it. It was like the lead role, and then I did like a bunch of like tests with the director, and then they went with someone else, and I was like, man, that sucks. I guess I'll do this Horrible Bosses thing.
Oh, shit.
You know, like...
Did the other movie come out?
Yeah.
Did it not do well?
No.
Sweet.
Yeah.
What was it called?
Should I talk about it?
Yes, come on. You can
what
talk
a
about
scoop.
It.
I don't give a fuck. It was sure. It was like 30 seconds or less, which look, I like Jesse Eisenberg. Jesse Eisenberg's fine.
Right.
He's doing great. But that's different. He had already been in The Social Network. He'd established himself. I think maybe if I'd had that role and the movie didn't turn out good, that would have been like, well, nah, see, the guy can't carry a film.
Good point.
You know?
But Horrible Boss is great, and Seth is great.
And Seth was great. And then that was fortunate, too. I mean, fortunately, Seth was great. I think I was the first guy to sign on to that movie. They could have surrounded me with like really bad actors as the bosses and bad cast and the director. So like,
and he was in the same position that you were in, coming off of what he had come off of with Kong, right?
Yeah, a little bit.
So
right?
Like, it was sort of like he had this sort of quirky movie that was amazing, that had a rabid fan base, and his next thing, which was a complete departure, like an actual scripted comedy.
Yeah.
Could have really not, you know.
He had a Four Christmases in between Christmases the two of those.
But that was that in between? It wasn't between the two.
But supposedly he was like, had a really difficult experience filming that movie, and they like, he wasn't treated very well by some people. So, this was the Horrible Bosses was his first thing where he was like given the chance to really direct.
But as a comedy fan, those are the kind of movies that you love, where they just sort of like come out of nowhere and you're like, holy shit, that movie that was really fucking funny. Yeah.
But again, I think so much of that, like some of that really is luck and that sort of intangible thing of like, well, all the right people came together at the right time and tonally this just happened to work and it's the right time and place for the movie. I could not be sitting here right now. but my day job's been good. Sunny's been good.
It's a good mindset to have when you're especially if you're like to go through the audition process. I think your mindset's the good mindset to have is to not, you know, like, well, you know, I'll try to do this thing. If it doesn't work, fuck it. What am I going to do?
And the audition process, that's crazy. I quit it. Like
me too. Except you actually work and you still quit the audition process.
Well, I quit it because I had Sonny, and Sonny was great, and I knew I could write for myself, and I was like, I'll just do this. I'm not gonna go jump through hoops anymore. And I had a bunch of auditions over the course of Sonny that were just sort of humiliating and not good.
They're never good.
Yeah, and then when Going the Distance came around, which was like a Justin Long movie that I did a thing in, and I met with the director, and she really liked me, and the producers love Sonny and stuff, and then one of the studio heads didn't know me and was like, well, I want to see him come audition. Well, I was like, go fuck yourself.
I'll just go run my show. Yeah. Thanks, though.
Yeah, and then finally, I got a part, you know, and then this sort of have been that way ever since.
It is such a, I mean, for any performers out there who actually, but I feel like more people do this now than used to, but just the idea of being a creative force on your show, I think there's a level of confidence now where I think you, if you were just an actor, you might not have been like, go fuck yourself for that audition. Because now you go, oh, well, I make stuff, so I don't fucking need to go tap dance.
Well, that's the
you.
Only reason why. Yeah, and I had done 6 billion auditions, and it's not a natural experience. First of all, I sound a little weird. You know, I look funny, and in short, out of context bursts, it might not make sense. You know, if I were, I also change a lot of the dialogue sometimes and things that I'm in, which you don't necessarily want to do in an audition because then they don't know what they're going to get. And so, to some degree, I suck at it.
It's a very artificial process, and it's not indicative at all of what you would do if you were actually working on a set.
Yeah, then there were other things where I know, oh no, that was great. I know I was hysterical in that. How dare you go with that unfunny person or whatever? Which is, and by the way, now after 9 seasons of casting people, I also know we see people all the time that are probably perfect for the job, and just for whatever reason, we're like, they're not quite how I see the character. And maybe they would have been great, maybe they would have been terrible, but it's such a ridiculous process of auditioning.
So you basically have what it's like. You have 1 minute, and a lot of the time, it doesn't even matter what you do. The second you walk in, like you said, if you look and go, it's just not, then it doesn't matter what they do.
Yeah, oftentimes it's like they're just not the person.
I think that those moments where you like you fucking grab the job and win it are few and far between, because I think a lot of the times does this person look like the character we had in mind? Then on top of that, if they can nail it, great.
Yeah, and some people are great at it and they know how to do it. To me, it was always just weird. In your reading with someone who's not an actor or not the actor, you're not in the environment. It's just a really strange.
It's always so weird to me when they'll do something. It's like, do you want to stand up or sit down? And you're like, in the script, the guy's standing. Why would you? Don't give me the option. Now I'm fucking thrown off.
I like to go in and do ridiculous amounts of space work. Or just start preparing something.
A lot of miming.
I'm opening cabinets. And
all right, imagine over here there's a fire.
I went out for a horror movie just like a couple weeks ago, and there was a lot of stuff I had to see and react to.
Yeah.
And like it was just like
a poltergeist?
It was like a poltergeist situation.
If you were to remake a poltergeist?
So if you were to remake poltergeist situation took place in.
Yep.
And like, you know, you want them to maybe like, you know, give you a little bit of notice of like where there's a sound or something like that. And then it's just like the self-consciousness just starts pouring into you.
That's where they should have the good sense to be like, this is Keith, our casting ghost. He's in our assistant. Yeah. He's a ghost that's going to come in and help. And you're going to read opposite him.
Yeah, it sucks. And I tried to riff by going, ghost.
And that doesn't work either.
It's in it.
it didn't work.
Yeah, no, it didn't. Just like there was a time I had like three auditions in one day, and like two of them were just real big comedy things, and then the last one was like for a drama, and then I didn't switch gears, and they're like, they stopped me in the middle.
So you're right in the thick of it. You're doing auditions all the time.
Yeah.
It's a tough place to be. I did it for years. I mean, you know, 12, 13 years, maybe 14 years, and you know, well, you get what, maybe one out of 25, 50? I don't know the numbers, but if you're lucky, that's tough.
Yeah.
That's actually part of the reason why we made the TV show. I was always testing for TV shows. They'd be like, oh, he could be like a funny best friend. And then they'd realize, well, we got a lot of white people. We can't have a white funny best friend. We need diversity.
Oh, my God. Like, you and I are the – you know, because people always say, like, you guys look like brothers. I think it's us and Aaron Paul and then the guy from Muse, Matt who's the guy from Muse?
Yeah, the guy from Muse is always going out for auditions.
No. I'm saying like we're in a club of similar looking white guys.
I remember seeing Aaron Paul a lot actually when I was first starting to audition for things, being like, "Huh, who's this guy? Could he be any good?"
Yeah.
It turns out he's all right.
Turns out he's great.
I have one of those guys. He's doing really well right now.
And I'm sure Aaron Paul had this guy, had Jeremy Renner. Oh, that Jeremy Renner. You know.
But Aaron Paul must have done it through the auditioning route. He must have, you know, I don't know if he auditioned for Breaking Bad, but he must have auditioned for enough things that someone saw. And it was not going to happen for me that way. You know, like, I always pictured it like a slot machine, like auditioning was like putting coins in a slot machine. You know what I mean?
And sooner or later,
Sonny
was
building my own slot machine.
Yeah.
Which was like, you know, I'll keep doing this. In the meantime, I'm going to do my own thing. And then eventually, you know, my own thing started paying out. And then I was like, well, I got the money from this slot machine. I don't need that.
Yeah.
And then that slot machine just started giving me money. Like, I didn't have to read
it. I didn't even put change in there. Just take this.
Just take it. All right.
Three sevens.
All right.
Yeah, well, it's that feeling when you, like, that moment where you got to basically, even though you may not have said it to his face in that way, but to say, like, fuck you, I'm not going to audition. Oh, that's such a gift. That's such a magical moment where you don't, the second you don't need it, where you can be
great.
Like, oh, because you're
all my ages were like, you're crazy. Like, everyone wants you for this. Go just. I actually just had that pop up again where some executive at Fox was unfamiliar with my work, and they were trying to put together a film. And he's like, well, have him come in and read for me. I'm like, Fox? I've been making Fox money for a decade. Yeah. You know, like, screw Fox.
And I'm sure he can get a screener of a couple episodes of your show.
Go see a thing.
Yeah. No, I want to control this guy for a minute and have him dance around in my office so I can tell him what's
wrong. But that was different than I didn't mind sitting with the director and reading through the script with him. That's sort of a different thing. Like, I don't mind working on something with the director. I'm not, like, above that. But that felt more human.
Well, it's different. There's a difference between let's work out and figure out how this might make sense as opposed to come in and prove yourself for me. Like, that's a much different experience where, you know, it's like you said, well, the guy could watch an episode of Sunny or he could, you know.
Right.
But or even if he just said, oh, hey, you know, I just want to come in and talk to you and meet with you and just get a sense. I feel like there's more to be gained from that than making someone come in and read two lines. Like, if I sat down and talked to you for 10 minutes.
Yeah, that's a very different thing.
I'd know, like, oh, this guy's funny. He can riff, you know. Like, he'd be, okay, great. Great, great, great.
We were casting a pilot that we wrote once called Boldly Going Nowhere. And I really wanted Martin Short to play the lead. And I was getting some, like, resistance from, obviously, like, executives and stuff. And he came in. We had a meeting with him. And I asked him, I'm like, listen, I hate to say this, but I'm getting resistance about having you be the lead. Would you ever be interested in, like, reading some stuff and let me put you on tape? And he was like, I'll read stuff with you, you know, you and me, if you want to read stuff, but not with them. And then I was, like, humiliated that I even asked him. I felt, like, so embarrassed. And then I also knew I was never going to get it through, so we didn't do it. And we should have cast him because he would have been great, and the show probably wouldn't have picked up. But
was it a space show?
Yeah. Yeah. He would have been great. He would have been our captain of a spaceship.
God damn it!
He would have been really good.
Oh, God, just that missed opportunity hurts my soul a little bit.
Yeah, and it was, like, one of those things where... Well, who knows? Maybe it still would have been bad. It would have been our fault. But he would have been great.
That's awesome.
But yeah, the whole audition thing is weird. I remember I auditioned for Euro Trip 2. Or no, not Euro Trip 2, but Euro Trip. They did Road Trip with, like, Tom Green. And then a couple years later, they did Euro Trip. And, you know, it must have been like 27 or 26, younger maybe. And I remember feeling, like, really good. Like, wow, I really gave a really sort of, like, subtly funny, quirky, interesting, you know, read. And quirky is not the right word, but just, like, it's just because what people say about me, but I wasn't intending to be that way. But and I remember the feedback that my agent said, which was, like, that the casting director said, yeah, he's an interesting guy. I don't think comedy is his thing. He's not really ever going to work in comedy.
Wow. Oh, Jesus.
You know, just so many stories like that. I mean, like, this is crazy. I can't even get past the person to get to the person.
Well, you get stuck in this lower to middle management area where – and then they'll say things like that. And I hope for anyone listening who's been through that you don't listen to those people when they say
that. Yeah, just keep pressing on,
because no one
–
they don't know. They're just saying stuff to say stuff, and it doesn't really matter. I was – what was what was it? I was going to – I wanted to a few years back audition for something. I don't know. It was some show that was on that I really wanted to be on – that I wanted – like, this role came up for this kind of, like, nerdy science guy, and I want to go for it. And the casting person told my manager that I wasn't fuckable enough. He was like, he's not fuckable enough.
Oh, see, that is the worst.
And it's just like, I can't even come in and read for it. Jeez. You know, like, it was a show that I was actually willing to go in and read for. And I so, you know, I so wanted to, I went into douche mode where the manager was like, I've got to tweet that out that guy said that. And he's like, why would you do that? You're just going to look like an asshole. I'm like, God damn it. You're right.
Yeah, you got to take the high road.
So I'll just talk about it on a podcast.
Turns out someone thinks I'm not fuckable enough, right, Twitter? Tell me I am.
Well, that's the thing.
Tell me I am.
That's why it's douchey, is because ultimately you're trying to get people to validate you because your ego is hurt.
Yeah.
And because you feel like, you know, although I feel like it was kind of douchey on that guy's part, but still, it was douchey the way that I took it, because I should have just been like, eh.
Yeah. But that's all. That's all they're looking at people like for a lot of those things. It's like, no one's gonna want to fuck
you. You know,
him.
Sometimes we have egos that bruise because we're sensitive.
It's tough.
Types.
You take a pounding.
It is, and because you are essentially doing a job that requires you to be kind of empathic and sensitive and aware. But the side effect to that is that you are sensitive and hyper aware and empathic. And so you just, it's hard to not, it's so easy to go down the douche road. It is so fucking easy to go down the douche road.
What's
but because
slide,
of your
really?
Ego, it's a slide that cleans your asshole.
Yeah. You actually have to learn to really not care. I think that's my friends who are doing the best at just auditioning and getting jobs through that. I think they really don't care.
I think it's not caring, to tell someone to not care is tough. I think it's a side effect to just being comfortable with yourself. If you're comfortable with yourself, then you don't care. It's not about just
you have to do the work. You can't like not care.
Yeah, it's not going, I don't care. Like, well, obviously you care because you're going out of your way to say that you don't care. It's really just, I think confidence just comes from just being comfortable with who you are and feeling like you have options.
And knowing, like, you would bring this thing to the project, which is like, all right, this is what I would bring to it. Yeah. If that's what they want, great. Yeah. If that's not what they want, then maybe I'm not the right person because that's what I would have done.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
And look, maybe a lot of those things I auditioned for years and years and years ago, I wasn't ready to get. Like, maybe I needed, 5, 6 years of Sunny
it's all working
to get
out.
Good at. Now things are working out.
Well, I'm so glad we finally were able to have you on. I mean, this was you are another person that when we first started doing the podcast, people were like, you got to get Charlie. Oh, you're not on Twitter anymore either, are you?
I'm not. I was on for like half a year and then I was like, I'm like writer's block and I have this thing I feel like I need to check every day and then the sort of emotional ride of how many people tell you they love you, and then I got a lot of people that were angry I was Jewish even though I'm not Jewish. Like a lot of just like too much. Like I suddenly thought I don't want a place for people to be able to write me directly, whether they know I'm reading it or not. I don't want to give people the option of like, I know that I'm writing directly to this person, so I just want that freedom.
That is a bold move in today's interconnected social media
society. I
think
it could be dumb. I think it's really going to like...
I think it's working out okay. And also, there's a certain... It's sort of like what you said about, some people being everywhere.
Yeah.
Is that, you're not. Like, when people find you in something, it's sort of special because they don't,
I think that helps Sonny. I think that helps Sonny live. Like, we weren't shoved down people's throats. We've never been in a comedy issue of Variety or GQ. It drives me crazy every time I read those things. But like,
we've been on for 9 years. What do you guys want?
Yeah, I mean, like, there's a little chip on my shoulder about those things, the Emmys, whatever. But like, at the same time, it's kind of good. People find it themselves. It doesn't feel like it's shoved down their throat. And this is like day and age where we're living in, where everything's jammed down your throat. I think
you still get to feel like the indie underdog to people
a little bit. Yeah.
Which is, I think, but certainly in the spirit of the show too. I think it all works,
but not so indie underdog that we'll only do 12 episodes and then walk away forever.
No. That's foolish. That's just foolish.
That's New Zealand
or British. Yeah. It's British.
It's very British.
Yeah.
And it drives me crazy. Like, the British Office, I wish they did more and more of that.
Yeah.
I love it so much,
Should we do more? Nah, we got it.
No, we did it. Why would we do more?
Because it was good. Yeah, it was good. Why should we do more?
It's 12 then, right?
No. I'm going to go do something else now. I'm going to go do 6 episodes of something else.
Yeah.
And the other thing they did was really good.
Oh, yeah, what?
Extras?
Yeah, that was great.
I want that to keep going.
Yeah, guys, just keep it going.
Yeah.
They don't understand that in England. They just kind of go, huh?
They don't.
Except for Doctor Who, thankfully.
They must all come from money.
That's
just
the only
just
way.
Just a bunch of rich kids out there making good TV.
Well, thank you for coming on Pacific Rim, July 12th. This is actually a Pacific Rim week because you're going up. This is going up Wednesday, and Charlie Hunnam went up today.
Oh, really?
Episode. So it's Charlie Pac Rim week.
Yeah.
We need
How
one
was that?
More. It was great.
Yeah. He's an interesting guy.
He was really interesting. He talked for a while about he wants to do this movie about Vlad the Impaler, and he knows so much about Vlad the Impaler that he was telling these Vlad the Impaler stories, and they were fucking fascinating.
Really funny.
They're really funny Vlad stories. It's a comedy turn.
Yeah,
it's sort of a Mel Brooks Vlad the Impaler, and there's a question mark at the end.
Yeah.
I don't know that.
This is impaling?
Like an Eastern European pornographic actor.
Yeah.
I don't know Vlad the Impaler.
The Dracula.
Really? That's what he's called?
Vlad the Impaler is the legend of Dracula came from Vlad Tempest, who was a basically a guy who ruled this little kingdom and was and he defeated larger armies because he was fucking insane.
That's an amazing
insane
name.
In a good way. But because he would impale people in front of the castle to warn other people, don't fuck with me.
That's so great.
You talked about it in front of that Bram Stoker's Dracula, right?
A little bit what?
They had that. Like,
a little bit, yeah. There was a little bit of the story at the beginning of Bram Stoker's Dracula.
I just exposed my ignorance.
Okay. Not really. You just, it's just one thing that you didn't know, which is nice. You don't have to know.
There's like five of them, though, and then I don't want you guys to guess.
So Vlad is one.
Vlad's one. I had no idea.
Unicycling is another.
God damn it.
Define cycling.
Any cycling.
It's like a foot car. It's like a foot car.
What is this foot car thing?
And then you're not on Twitter, which I think is admirable.
Yeah, I don't know. Or it's just crazy. Like,
no, it's not crazy. I think it's cool.
There was also a piece of me that got worried about like being up for a movie and some executive being like, let's see. Well, Charlie's got 500,000 followers, but Ashton Kutcher's got 8.
They do that.
Having like a number to quantify me. Although all I did was just make that number 0.
Yeah, which is kind of cool.
I still have a number.
But then they'll never know what it could have been.
That's true. Yeah. They don't know my potential number.
Yeah. I was walking by, I was working in the E building. I was walking by an office and I heard a lady go, well, this guy's got more Twitter followers than the other one.
Right? See?
Oh, I heard some awful things in that building.
Yeah.
I heard a development pitch one time where a guy goes, so I think he was pitching a reality show. This is honest to God, I am not making this up. The guy goes, so our cast is going to have, like, I feel like everyone's already seen the sassy black lady, but our sassy black lady's from Detroit. No one's seen one from Detroit yet. Like, those were his fucking exact words.
Wow.
I'm like, this is how shows here are made. Are you fucking kidding me?
You just hear him in, like, the lobby area getting coffee.
Oh, it just hurt. Yeah. It just hurt. It was one of those ones where I wanted to just, like, and for a comedy moment, I really should have done this, just open the door and be like, are you serious? And then just closed the door and then walked away and never showed my face again.
Yeah. Those conversations do happen where they're like, they'll be like, well, dogs and skateboards are trending. So can we have like a dog
Poochie.
On a skateboard in the middle
Poochie
of the
dog.
Movie?
Yeah.
No, when I was writing on The Soup, there was like a lot of those like comments coming down from up above. Wow. Or just like, it's like, hey, this is doing real big right now. Let's get a sketch out by the end of the day.
It's a soulless hybrid of corporate thinking.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully you'll come back on sometime later.
Yeah.
Anytime. Yeah. You're welcome on anytime you want.
This is a real bad dismount for a date.
This is, hopefully you want to.
This is me.
Another time, maybe.
Yeah, well, weird to do the dick and the popcorn when you're not in a movie. That's the weird time to actually do.
More confused to where you got the popcorn.
There's a popcorn. We know where you got the dick.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. I mean, we're just like, we're right off Sunset Boulevard. It's not that hard to get a dick.
You get it.
Even at this hour.
Lots of dicks anytime.
Yeah, anytime. Just go over to Guitar Center. There's a whole used dick section.
Yeah, they're all playing them. Roll out.
Hey!
They're all listening over there, and they're crossing the street.
Oh, here they come.
Here they come.
Here they come. Charlie Day, actor, writer, fellow scruff enthusiast.
Mm-hmm. Scruff mutt, you call this.
Scruff mutts! We're scruff mutts! Yeah. We're going to do an animated show called Scruff Mutts.
We got the pitch.
Yep. Because you mean it, too, because you're scruffy.
Oh, thanks.
Kyle's got a full beard, so he can't be in it.
We just need a sassy black mutt from Detroit.
But not that's been done now.
Seen it.
Not a dog.
Oh.
What a bitch.
Yo.
Oh. Oh. I'm a bitch. Scruff mutt.
Scruff mutt. Do 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 do. And
that's good.
Scene. Right. Enjoy, Bruce. We have to break things.
I'm not going to break it.
You did listen to all of this.
Those are plastic bottles.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast is brought to you by LegalZoom.com. Whatever your legal document needs, LLCs, wills, trusts, trademarks, and more, they've got it. Over 12 years and 2 million Americans have used LegalZoom. Start your business or protect your family today at LegalZoom.com using the offer code Nerdist.
In the climate-ravaged year of 2072, the city of Pura stands as a miraculous green haven, a geoengineered paradise that protects fortunate residents from the global catastrophes of heat domes, fires, floods, and droughts. Demetria Lopez heads up Pura's public relations, tirelessly promoting the city's idyllic image. But when she stumbles upon a dark secret that, if exposed, would be the downfall of Pura's existence, she must decide who and what she is willing to protect. From Wondery, the makers of Academy and Dr. Death, The Last City stars actors Reyes Seahorn, Jeannie Tirado, and Maury Sterling. Follow The Last City on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of The Last City early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.